Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started today for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, rating and downloading. Christmas is nearly here. To celebrate, we're giving you the gift of our favourite features from the show this year. Coming up on this week's programme, creating mirror life and the science of embalming. Not very Christmassy features, I have to admit, but they are really good. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. We get to all of those comments at the end of the programme. Now, this piece was an absolute standout for me on the show because we spoke to a researcher who had been working towards creating something very exciting and revolutionary in medicine, mirror life, and then realised that could be an absolute disaster and ended all of her research and is now working hard to get everyone to stop working on mirror life. Have a listen to this. Imagine a world where life exists, but entirely backwards, where every molecule, every strand of DNA is the mirror image of what it should be. Researchers are already exploring the possibility of creating mirror life, organisms built from the reverse versions of life's building blocks. But what would that mean? Well, Dr. Kate Adamala is Associate Professor of Genetics, Cell Biology and Development at the University of Minnesota. She joins me now. I think you are the first researcher from the University of Minnesota to come on the program, Kate. So you're very welcome.
Then it's my honor.
So I know a little bit about this, but the more I read about it, the less I felt I knew. So let's start off with the basics. When you talk about left hand or right hand or mirrors, what exactly are we talking about?
Every molecule, every complex organic molecules, like the molecules that build our cells, every molecule has a certain shape. And the way those molecules are structured is that they can point one way or another. And there's basically two different options.
What does that mean?
It means if you look at your hands, your left hand and your right hand, they're sort of identical, but they're mirror images of each other, like they're pointing in two different ways. And the same is true for every other molecule. Every complex biological molecule can be like your left hand or your right hand. So they're technically identical, except they're like mirror images of each other. And everything that makes your body can be that.
And so how does that affect... Because molecules, sometimes they click together, don't they? Like
all the time. That's kind of their whole thing, is to click together with other molecules. That's how cells work.
Right. Okay. So a molecule might sort of have a certain like Lego shape and it clicks into something else and then they transfer information between the molecules, or it starts to create stuff like proteins. That's how molecules work?
Yep, exactly.
God, we're solving all the problems today. And so... presumably then, if you had a left-handed molecule, it would not be able to do what a right-handed molecule does on a right-handed...
Yes.
You know, in the right-handed world, so to speak.
Exactly. A left-handed Lego brick will click with other left-handed Lego bricks, but not with a right-handed Lego bricks. So you can have those two very similar but not interchangeable sets of Lego bricks that don't work between each other, but work with the ones that are the pointing the same way. So that's the whole idea behind this opposite life.
Why do we have left and right? I'm trying to think in the obviously symmetry is everywhere in nature, but I'm wondering why? Why don't we just have two left hands, two left feet? Why do we need a left and a right at all?
Because it's carbon's fault. Carbon is the atom that is at the center of all organic molecules that make life on Earth. And the way carbon is built kind of enforces that property of molecules, because carbon is not completely symmetrical. If you have four different things attached to a carbon, that's going to create that property of those things attached to carbon can be in different orientations to each other. That's what we call chirality of molecules.
And chirality. So
chirality is the word that describes this pointing left or pointing right. And because of that molecule that's at the center of all of biology, carbon, it can have things attached to it that makes it basically be left-handed or right-handed. That then translates to all of the rest of biology. So goblin carbon.
Right. And so do we have like a mix of these molecules in our body, or in a living organism, would it be mostly left, if you're that sort of an organism, would it be mostly left-leaning molecules?
We don't have a mix, because it would be a hot mess. If you as a living organism have to pick left or right.
What?
There is no way to have mixed.
Really?
Because then imagine the Lego bricks. If you had two different types of Lego bricks and you want to build together at, I don't know, Millennium Falcon or some other giant Lego assembly.
Yeah.
If your Lego bricks don't all agree on which way they're pointing, there is no way you're going to build a complex structure, because they just won't click with each other. So that's why life has to pick.
Right. Oh, well, I guess I was thinking maybe your heart is a lefty bit and then your blood might be a righty bit, but it doesn't work like that.
Doesn't work that way, because it's all starting from one cell. I mean, you used to be one cell back in your mother's ovary. And then that one cell started dividing into all the cells of your body. So once you pick stereochemistry or this chirality, you got to stick with it.
Huh. So are there people out there who are, I mean, like, are all humans left? Or are there some humans who are born right?
More than that, not just all humans, all life on Earth, everything, your dog, bacteria, plants, potatoes, you, your cousin, everything has the same chirality. All life that we know on Earth has the same chirality, because it all is connected, all evolved from one another.
But how do we know that there's a right then? Why do we call it left and right?
Because we made it. We made it in the lab. We can chemically made the other conformation, the other basically type of molecules. And so that's how we know they're possible, because we made them in the lab. They just can't interact with natural cells.
So you've made the, like, molecules, or like, has it gone?
Yep.
Theoretically, from what you're saying, theoretically, you could make living cells.
Theoretically, but yeah, we have not made cells. We only made molecules.
But molecules are building blocks of cells.
Yes.
So what would that mean then for a living, like, this is going to sound really stupid. I mean, presumably it would be visible and like it would look identical, but...
It would look identical to the naked eye, because we don't see that property of stereochemistry. There's nothing different between a peptide that points one way or another to your eye, but functionally they would be very different.
And so if these molecules are, I mean, I guess it's a fun thought experiment to think, wow, what would happen if we made these molecules that were the opposite but looked identical? But there's no, I mean, is there any point to making them? I mean, apart from that you can.
There is a lot of points, practical applications, because they would not be able to interact with rest of biology, which means predators and viruses would not attack those cells, which means you could do amazing biomanufacturing. So you could basically use them as a platform to produce things. And you would not be susceptible to anything coming from the outside and contaminating your bioreactor.
Until through one thing or another, you accidentally made right-handed viruses or right-handed bacteria.
Yes, that kind of, it would be difficult though. Making a mirror cell would be super difficult too. But because nothing would eat it, nothing would infect it, that's also the reason why we should not be making those cells, because if any accident happens and they happen to be released into the environment, you know, stuff happens, bioreactors leak, if a mirror cell ever leaked into the environment, then it would just live there and nothing would attack it. Nothing would eat it because nothing would recognize it as a proper food, proper living cell. And then it could just spread in the environment. And that's what we're worried about. And that's why we're saying mirror cells shouldn't exist.
I didn't know that's what you were saying. That's cool. I'm going to get to that in a second. But let's just go back a bit. Cells need fuel. Yeah. If they only interact with, say, we're going to say right-handed are the mirror cells that we're talking about. Okay. If they can't feed and can't reproduce because they need to find other cells or other right-handed material, then surely they just disappear.
So those problems are, if you're a cell, those problems are easily solvable. Oh. You reproduce by yourself, so you don't need bodies. Most cells, most single cells, and we're talking really simple bacteria-like cells, those cells reproduce by dividing themselves in half.
But they need fuel.
Yes, they need fuel, and there's plenty of fuel that they can use in the environment. Not all food stock for bacteria is chiral or points one way or another. There is a lot, those so-called achiral. For example, a really easy example, ethanol. A lot of bacteria can utilize ethanol as their food. They can process it. And that's not chiral. There is a lot of other, for example, the simplest amino acid, the only amino acid that's not chiral, glycine, that's plenty of it in the environment. There's a lot of sugars that are not chiral that can be found in the environment and the bacteria can eat it. So that's one, but that's not even, that we're not even done. That's one way, just finding a chiral food is one way that bacteria can live. The other way is there are enzymes that can flip this chirality. So in theory, you can imagine a mirror cell that has an enzyme that picks up nutrients from the environment and flips the chirality. Those enzymes exist in nature. So if you made a mirror cell, you could make that mirror version of those enzymes. And so you could imagine having a mirror cell that fends for itself in the wild pretty well.
This is the beginning of horror or sci-fi movie for sure. But if those enzymes exist in nature, then how come we don't see more just naturally occurring mirror cellular life?
Because it takes too much. Like, to make a mirror cell, you would have to have all of the components, that millions of molecules be of this opposite chirality. And those enzymes don't flip complex molecules. They only flip small, single building blocks. Okay. So there is no enzyme that will take like a whole peptide and flip it to the opposite chirality. It can only do it on single building blocks. And that doesn't get you to a whole cell unless you do it in the lab.
Okay. Well, not without billions of years of evolution, right? Or you do it in a lab, which is what you're saying we should absolutely not do for this reason. But at the same time, is it actually what you're also doing?
I used to be doing that. I used to think...
Oh, really?
Yeah, I used to think we should make mirror cells because the benefits for biology and medicine would be amazing. And I had funded research projects towards building mirror life. And then I started talking to ecologists and evolutionary biologists who I'm none of that. I'm a chemist. I don't have the deep understanding of how ecosystems work. And then I talked to people that do understand that. And they made me realize that if you make an organism that just lives in the environment without being attacked by any predators or viruses, that is a very bad news. That would be terrible for the environment because we don't want an organism that lives outside of all those regulatory mechanisms that normally guide life. And that's when I realized that I should not be doing what I'm doing. And I switched from saying yay mirror life to saying we absolutely should never make a mirror cell. And that's what I'm advocating for right now.
So this is so interesting that you're like, this is actually could be a really dangerous technology that we don't understand the consequences of it. What is worst case scenario if someone, and it sounds like if you're advocating for us not to do it, it sounds like there are people who are doing it who aren't you. What is worst case scenario if someone starts building mirror life, mirror cells that are not found in nature, but identical to biological life, but the reverse? What is the worst case scenario?
Yeah, if a robust mirror cell is ever made and released into the environment, we could see a very slow but very persistent infection spreading through the environment. Because mirror cells are, we call it invisible or stealth to the immune systems, they could infect pretty much anything they want. They could infect potentially plants, animals, and humans. And we can treat humans because we can make a opposite antibiotic, so mirror image antibiotic, and that's going to kill a mirror cell. But you cannot treat the whole of environment. If you have a persistent infection, for example, in a groundwater, it's just physically impossible to treat it. So that would be the worst case scenario, is we would start having this very persistent infection spreading through the environment. And that's why I would rather not get there. I would rather not make a mirror cell and not have to deal with that.
This is so fascinating. So I'm guessing they're mostly men.
Yeah.
But who are the people making mirror cells? Because, you know, through history, there's been a lot of guys who are like, let's just do it because it's cool, not necessarily because it's a good idea. The Oppenheimer question, right? So in this environment, who's making mirror cells and why are they doing that if this threat that you perceive is a generally accepted threat?
Yeah. So to take away some credit from the guys, I think there's plenty of women that would do it for the heck of it too. It's just through the history, we didn't get a chance because,
That's true.
But right now, I'm pretty, okay, I can't be 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure right now, nobody is actually making mirror cells.
Oh, really?
Because, so we published last December, even less than a year ago, we published a paper that's been very wildly noticed, discussed in the both scientific and policy community. It kind of made a splash and people came out and started saying, oh, begrudgingly, some of them, but okay, maybe you're right. And so right now, there is no researcher that's publicly saying they're trying to make a mirror cell. Everyone who worked on it, first of all, most people that used to publicly work on mirror cells are authors on that paper that say, let's not make mirror cells. So they publicly came out and said, okay, we're not doing it. And since we started having those public discussions after that paper, everyone who could, so that has the ability, has the lab with the right expertise to make mirror cells, came out and said, I believe you. And they stopped that particular line of research. So as of now, it's pretty good. That's obviously not going to, you know, we can't be responsible for future generations. We don't know what they're going to do, which is why I want to have laws on the book that says you cannot make a mirror cell. But for now, I'm feeling okay, because people that can make a mirror cell came out and said, I'm not stupid. I'm not going to make a mirror cell.
This is so wild. This is absolutely wild, the story. So, Kate, like, you could have potentially saved the world without even knowing it, right? By writing this paper. That is theoretically possible.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice thought.
But
nice thought.
Whenever someone says, oh, we need to stay away from this, this could be dangerous, my mind goes to the many people who have weaponized such thoughts. And I suppose, is there an easy way for the United States, China, Russia, bad actors, as each of them call each other, to turn this into some sort of a targeted or a serious weapon?
Not really. Obviously, it's possible for a bad actor to try it. But there are two reasons why I'm not particularly worried about weaponizing that technology. So just to be clear, I think bioweapons are absolutely terrifying, but there's plenty of perfectly good natural viruses and bacteria that are much easier to weaponize.
Right.
So if I was a bad actor trying to weaponize something, mirror life would be far down on my list for two reasons. One is because it doesn't exist. So to make a mirror life that's good enough to be a bioweapon, because, you know, you cannot have a wimpy bioweapon. If you want bioweapon, you need something robust. And to make a mirror cell that's robust, it's incredibly difficult. It doesn't exist yet. And we know there would be probably at least a decade, if not more, of work to make it happen. And there are already, you know, there's existing bugs like go weaponize smallpox. That's much better bioweapon.
No, don't go weaponize smallpox.
Don't go,
but I know what you mean. Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, that's one reason. The other reason, it would make a terrible bioweapon because you cannot protect your own population. If you make a bioweapon that kills everybody, what kind of bioweapons is that? I mean, that's a doomsday weapon. That's not a good bioweapon. Yeah. So no state actor is going to do that, because they couldn't protect their own people.
Okay. Let me play devil's advocate for a second and talk about basic research that has yielded so much just by understanding. And when we think about mirror cells, there's this entire untapped, ununderstood area of potentially biological life, but a whole realm of scientific discovery that we're just going to decide, no, we're not going to even try to go down that road, even though we don't know where it might lead us. Is that not, you know, from a scientific point of view, a little unsettling to you to leave that chapter just closed, the room dark?
Oh, absolutely. It is unsettling. And it wasn't an easy decision for me to, you know, come out and say that, to say that I don't make mirror life anymore, because it is, you're right, it is one of the most fascinating research problems that I ever worked on. But I also want my kids to have a world to live in. And that's...
Do you think it's that dangerous?
I do think so. I think if all the worst case scenario, it is really concerning. And I cannot tell you 100% for sure that it would be that dangerous. The only way to tell that would be to make it, release it, and wait, see what happens. And that's just not a risk anyone has any right to take. Because if we're wrong, then mirror life will get released and goes, curls up and dies and nothing happens. But if we're right, then mirror life gets released and everyone's screwed. And that's just not a risk anyone should take for any scientific purpose. Science is supposed to make life better, make humanity better, make the planet better. And mirror life, the concerns significantly outweigh the benefits. There is nothing in mirror life that we couldn't get by other types of synthetic biology.
Well, the follow-on I was going to ask is, I mean, considering it's a mirror image of a molecule, a mirror image of life, is there anything to suggest that, apart from it, you know, not being able to interact with pilot, is there anything to suggest that it could be useful for anything? I mean, as you say, could we not do everything using just left-handed biological life? Is there any perceived or hypothetical or proposed benefit to having mirror molecules?
Yes, there are benefits, and that's why we were doing it in the first place. There are benefits in using it as a production platform. So making molecules with biology, this whole bioeconomy that's coming to the world because we need it. That could be much easier if you have a mirror bioproduction, because you could make all the molecules you need without worrying that your bioreactor is going to get contaminated.
It's like a perfect clean room.
Exactly. It's a self-contained clean room. So that's one benefit. The other benefit is you could teach a mirror cell to produce a small molecule that's a drug, that's a pharmaceutical. And then if it's invisible to your immune system, you could possibly inject it into a patient and have this little factory, biofactory, circulating in the bloodstream, making a drug. And that would be a really good kind of a personalized medicine solution. But then again, you couldn't contain it. You couldn't control it. So that's why we should, despite it being sounding really good, we should not be going there. We can do all those things that I just mentioned with other types of synthetic cells. We don't need mirror cells to do that.
Man, this is so fascinating.
It's fascinating. And it's also one of the examples of how every research has consequences. We can't just assume something is safe or good because we think the benefits are good.
Yeah, you got me thinking now. I'm going to spend a bit of time thinking about this today, I think. It's like it depends on how you use it, right? Really interesting. Associate Professor of Genetics, Cell Biology and Development at the University of Minnesota, Kate Adamala. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McCrae. We're playing some of our favourite stories from the past for you. And we were really touched by the thoughtfulness and pride that Glyn Tallon took in his work embalming and reconstructing corpses for display for their loved ones. It is a graphic interview in some ways, and perhaps in many ways not the most Christmassy, but actually if you listen to Glyn speak about his work and what he does, I think you'll agree it is an area that we hardly ever think about, but actually at that moment of most need, it is probably the work that we really appreciate the most. Here's Glyn Tallon. Glyn, you're very welcome to the program. It is always great to speak to someone who is so passionate about their work. Before we talk about the science of it, maybe very briefly, you might explain how someone finds himself in the world that you're in, considering how difficult some people might imagine it is.
Yes, John, and thank you very much for having me on your show. My road into this job started going back many, many years ago. When I was a teenager, I became very, very interested in death care. And indeed, going back years ago, there was very, very little hygienic preparation done in our country, which is embalming.
Talk to me about the embalming process. When someone dies, let's not talk about traumatic deaths for the moment. If someone dies peacefully, why do they need to be embalmed? What is the biological process that happened that mean that we need to preserve them in the process of embalming?
Okay, well, the three main principles of embalming is sanitation, preservation, and presentation. So from a sanitation point of view is when somebody passes away, and take, for instance, if they were of a palliative nature, their body will decay, like not the natural process will happen. So the embalming will delay this completely. So that means there is no rush for somebody to be buried. Bear in mind, Jonathan, we're on this planet for quite some time. Mm. Why should we be rushed off it?
Yeah, but in terms of the decay, how quickly does it happen? Because we turn around funerals quite quickly here in Ireland. How quickly does the body decay to a stage where it cannot be presented in an open casket?
In some situations, it will take a couple of days. It depends on how somebody passes away, the amount of drugs that has passed through their body from a medical point of view.
Right.
So there's many different factors. Like there's no two deaths could sometimes is not the same. So it depends on their diet. It depends on the amount of medication they've been taken. Huh. So there's many factors in the play.
When we talk about embalming as opposed to the presentation part, what exactly is happening there to preserve that body?
Well, the embalming process is the hygienic preparation of a decedent starts with the infusion of the injection that we would give of an arterial solution. The solution will come in and replace the blood in the body. So that preserves the tissue and organs.
Right. Okay. So that where the blood would normally proliferate in the blood vessels, that blood begins to decay and pool, causing unsightly blotches and decay of the tissue. This fluid that you inject basically prevents that from happening, sort of fixes it. Is that right?
Yes. What happens is this is infused in the arterial system of the body, and the venous is taken out. So all the blood that you would see going through the veins on a lifelike person would be removed from the decedent. Mm. And the arterial solution would be placed in through the arteries of the body.
Okay. And that gives you time then for the other parts of your job.
Yes, indeed. So like we would be doing other, so when the injection is going in, we would be working on other parts of the decedent, like we would be washing and grooming at the same time.
And so once you have cleansed the body, it's been embalmed, There seems to me, when I've been to a number of wakes open caskets, it seems like there is an extraordinary difference between the look of someone who has died and the look of someone who is just sleeping. And I've always found it quite difficult to keep my eyes on a dead body because of that reason, because I often find that the person doesn't look anywhere close to being alive, and they often don't look
like they were only a few days ago. What is the cause for that waxy appearance that we see in dead bodies?
Well, it depends. It depends on the choice of fluids that the embalmer would use.
Right.
Personally speaking, I believe that somebody should look natural and lifelike, that they look as if they're asleep. It depends on the cosmetics that would be used. So again, there's many different factors. You can make somebody look a lot younger, or you could make somebody look like the stated age that they are. Many different parameters around this.
Well, I mean, in terms of, you know, when someone ages, obviously, or that when someone is unwell, they lose a lot of weight. When families come to you, do they give you images of what they would like their family member to look like in the casket? And how do you go about recreating that, please?
Yes. If a funeral director passes us a picture, take, for instance, if you go on RIP.ie, you will see lots of pictures of people up when they were living.
Mm.
So we would mimic these pictures. So this would give us great aids in regards to the complexion, the way their hair is done, the way their features are. So going by a picture would give us lots of avenues to go to get that desired appearance for the family.
Let's talk about the more tricky cases where there has been significant damage to the body. Can you take us through the various outcomes that lead it to be very difficult for you to work with an open casket and how you go about resolving those? Because, you know, some injuries, some diseases must be very disfiguring and very difficult to work back to that healthy individual that loved ones want to see in a casket.
Yes, indeed, Jonathan. We would come across this in a very on close to a weekly basis. And there's lots of dynamics with this. Take, for instance, if somebody passes away with an RTC, which is a road traffic collision, there's lots of parameters that we have to work around. Like, they would fall under the medical legal umbrella, so they would be subject to an autopsy examination.
Mm.
So we have to link in with the mortuaries and the mortuary technicians to see when the decedent would be released. This could be maybe a day or 2 or 3 days after the decedent had passed away.
Right.
So obviously the family is very, very keen to get their loved one back. Having said that, if we're employed to do the reconstructive work in cases like this, we give the parameters to the family of the time frame that we're going to need.
Mm.
Now, when this is explained to a family in detail, unfortunately, it has to be the harsh reality because they want to know when they're going to get their loved one back.
Yeah.
We have to give a time frame. So within that time frame, we could sometimes work through the night on cases like this because, you know, we're trying to cut down the hours to get the decedent back to the family sooner. Very important factors that we have to work with. We would need pictures because if we're working with a lot of disfigurement due to the road traffic collision, you know, the picture is giving us a very, very good guide. We may need to speak to the family throughout while we're doing our work in regards to different features and parts, how somebody would look. Now, bear in mind, there's some people don't like getting pictures taken. So we come across these situations where somebody may not have been in a picture for the last 5, 7, 10 years.
Mm.
So this is where the creativity has to come in. And this is where the art really starts to shine through. So you're mimicking one side of the face to the other.
Right. So if you have one side of the face, you can reconstruct the other side. And I suppose that makes sense. Just if you've just joined us, we're speaking to Glyn Tallon from Tallon Mortuary Specialists. Just a fair warning, we are talking about reconstructive work after traumatic deaths. So when you have something as traumatic where the face is not fully intact, how on earth do you go about piecing that together from a scientific point of view? How do you technically put someone back together for an open casket?
Okay, well, we get back to the basics and we start from the known parts that we can identify. And we start rebuilding the bone from the known parts. So these little steps are very, very small steps that we're taking at a time. So this is why it has to be so intricate and detailed, because we get to portions of the face and you're looking at, if you're out a couple of millimetres, that changes completely what we're going to be passing back to the family. So we're looking very, very closely at placing all the bones back together. Sometimes the bone can be so badly damaged that we have to recreate them.
You recreate bones to reconstruct the structure of someone's face?
Yes, we would use prosthetics to use this. Yeah.
Wow. And what about the, you know, where the incisions meet together? I mean, is it easy to, because obviously if God forbid I ever find myself in that situation where someone has had a traumatic death, looking at a face that has, you know, clear lines down the middle where that face has been cut apart, that would be very difficult. How do you go about putting skin back together in a way that doesn't seem like it's been sutured?
Yeah, for many years, embalmers would have used different variances of wax to do this.
Wax?
We would blend the wax into the incision. Mm. Now, things has moved on a great deal since then, and we now use silicone.
Right.
Now, the silicone would be blended in, but it has to be also smoothed off, obviously, to marry into the tissue and also contoured. So take, for instance, on a male especially, if you had kind of a stubbly complexion or maybe not as smooth as complexion on your face, well, we have to make it look so it matches in with this. So if you see one part that's smooth and the other that isn't, well, we haven't got a good match there. So we need to blend it in.
Wow.
So you're looking at this is where things start to get very, very tedious. So we're looking at the blending and then cosmetics to go over this. And we're trying to keep things as opaque as possible, going by what colour we're looking at.
I presume the mindset of a mortician, as they're going into a project like that, as soon as they start working on it, it becomes, a technical task where they're focused very much on getting something correct. Because surely, from a survival point of view, you can't continuously be emotionally involved in the patients you're working with.
Yes, to an extent. Bear in mind, I have a family. There's people in my life I love, and like, you can't help but say to yourself, what if it was one of my family members? I'd want them looked after, and the person looking after them, I'd want them to care. So to a degree, you know, you'll always have that with you. Having said that, we're trying to get the best result we can for that family. So I wouldn't say you're emotionally involved, but like, you're 100% concentrating to get the best results for this family.
Okay, so we go through the process of embalming to preserve the tissue. And then if there's reconstructive work, you use various techniques to do that. And then there's the presentation part where you use makeup and presumably other materials to try and restore that person. Can you take us through that final part of presentation? How you do that? And is it just as simple as, you know, putting on makeup on a living person, or are there other adaptations that you need to do to ensure this person looks as they were before they died?
Yeah, the finish is, you know, that's paramount. There is no doubt about it. Our finish on cases like this, Jonathan, take for instance, if we had somebody ready to be coffined, when I say coffined, to be placed in their coffin, and they're close to be ready to be viewed, the finish could be taken about 3 to 4 hours.
Wow.
So the detailed work starts to go in then. So we would place the decedent in the coffin, and then we would do the finish, because we've got them in a certain position how the family is going to view them. We would possibly change the lights and bring them into our finishing area so the lighting is changed, so we don't have bright light shining on them. So we're going to see them exactly how the family is going to view them. So the finish is paramount.
What sort of understanding of the anatomy of the human body do you need to um, to to do this job, Glenn? Because it sounds like, you know, you're essentially doing the work of a reconstructive surgeon, and then some. Is there a big crossover? I mean, do you study human anatomy to become an advanced reconstruction specialist?
Yes, you know every bone in the body. You know every layer of tissue. That's part of your training as an embalmer. Your training is very, very in-depth in these areas. There's no doubt about that.
Are there cases where you need to work with hair? Do you have like a stock of wigs and beards and so on, or how does that work?
Yes, we would keep a stock of natural hair. We would have multiple different colors. We would have, you name it, from a color point of view, we would have it and keep it in stock. Take, for instance, if we had somebody that underwent neurosurgery and unfortunately didn't pull through their operation or passed away in an intensive care unit, mm-hmm. and their hair could be shaved on one side of their head, we would replace that.
Of course, yeah. God, I never thought about all of the intricate steps that go into reconstructing a body for an open casket. Are there cases that an open casket is impossible?
I don't believe this. We have, over the years, I'm doing this job close to three decades, Jonathan. I've never refused to do a case. We will take on any kind of reconstructive case. Like, we've often done cases that has been in the water for 42 days was the longest submerged decedent that we ever had. Wow. And we managed to make that deceased viewable for the family. Trauma cases in the way of RTCs, the road traffic collisions.
Or burns, of course, burn victims.
Same. Burn victims can be a little bit harder from the point of view that their tissue, depending on how much we would get of the deceased, they can be the hard ones to deal with. Mm. But there's nothing that we won't do for a family.
I know that you are religious, and I'm wondering, does that help you in a way in your job? And does it shape how you view this? Because for me, I suppose I wonder, why is it so important for people to see their loved one's face once they've died? Why do we as a culture need to see that face before they're buried? Maybe you might talk to me a little bit about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, my take on that is, Jonathan, when I go out the door in the morning, I say goodbye to my wife and give her a kiss, and my children too. Mm. When I come home in the evening, you get greeted by your children, your wife, or your family. So we say hello and goodbye. To say goodbye to somebody, you know that they're gone to work. What about the people that doesn't come home and you don't get to say goodbye to them? Mm. You know, when you think about that.
Yeah.
The penny kind of drops with a lot of people then. Well, you don't get to say goodbye to somebody that you love, and they end their way to work and their life is possibly taken.
It makes you think, doesn't it?
It does. It does indeed.
It's, I mean, I'm not a religious person, but I think it's fair to say it's God's work that you're doing. Glenn Tallon is with Tallon Mortuary Specialist. Thank you so much for coming on the program and telling us about your work.
Pleasure, Jonathan. Thanks for having me on your show.
All right, time to look back at some of your comments from last week. And we had Tyler Stevenson on the program from the University of Glasgow. He's talking about the gene that switches in animals to turn on winter mode and turns off for summer mode, obviously. He says, Breda says, do humans have a seasonal gene like hibernating animals? I tend to feel sluggish in winter. I wonder if there's any overlap there. Indeed, there is. I think Tyler talked about in the program that there is a switch, but its effects are sort of mitigated by the fact that we tend to wear clothes and we do things to, adjust for light changes. Like, we've got artificial light and we've artificial heat through clothes. And so the effect isn't as strong, but there is an effect for sure. We also spoke to John Laffey from the University of Galway about a controversial study that looked at trying to breathe through your backside. Lisa says, how safe is it to pump oxygen-rich
rich liquid up the rectum. Would it hurt or cause long-term damage? Well, this study was a phase one study that looked at it and found that it's relatively safe. Although I think there were one or two people who did feel mild discomfort, as you might. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin and Hugo De Silva Scott on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.
This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like Jojo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com.